Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
In today's Africa Link program, it's World Refugee Day. We'll head to Burundi, which is home to over 600,000 refugees and asylum seekers.
The UNHCR would like to say that Burundi didn't fail its mission with regard to refugees, even when the country faced difficulties. Burundi continued to open doors for refugees.
We have some of your responses to this story that you've been sending us via Facebook and WhatsApp.
And the UN Human Rights Chief accuses authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo of backing a new militia behind horrific attacks in the Kasai provinces. These stories and more coming up. Hello and welcome to Africa Link. We're coming to you live from Bonn, Germany. I'm Eunice Njiro.
And I am Abubakar Jallo with some of the stories that have been trending on social media and your responses as well on Facebook.
Before we get started, let's find out what's been happening around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. A suicide car blast in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, has killed at least 10 people and injured 18 others. The blast, claimed by Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab militants, hit a government building as local officials were holding meetings. Police said many of the dead are civilians. The blast comes less than a week after the militant group killed at least 31 people in an attack on a hotel also in Mogadishu. A South African public watchdog has criticized the country's central bank on Tuesday, saying in an interview that the bank should worry more about the concerns of the people and less about the country's currency rating. The head of the watchdog said the central bank's mandate was focused on commercial interest, while the bank responded saying such comments are unlawful. The row comes as South Africa's economy has sunk into recession and as President Jacob Zuma's leadership continues to be questioned. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi has on Tuesday marked World Refugee Day. In a statement, Grandi offered praise for refugees and also for host nations.
On June 20, World Refugee Day, we honor the resilience and courage of more than 65 million people who have been forced to flee war, persecution, and violence. But it is also a moment to recognize those communities and people around the world who receive refugees.
This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. German Chancellor Angela Merkel on Tuesday has urged the EU's remaining 27 members to work together during talks on Britain's exit from the bloc, after British and EU negotiators agreed on a Brexit timetable at the first meeting in Brussels on Monday. Speaking at a German industry conference, Merkel said the talks are important for the future of European integration.
Let's stay together, let's not divide from each other. This is not just about the exit of Britain, who we want to remain friends with and who we want to have a good partnership with, but it's also about the future of the European Union.
A diplomat from the Catholic Church has reported that at least 3,400 people in the Democratic Republic of Congo have died from violence stemmed between the country's army and local militia groups. After a tribal chieftain openly challenged the authority of President Joseph Kabila's government last year, the UN rights chief has called for an international investigation into crimes committed by all sides in the conflict. At least 8 people have drowned after an overloaded boat capsized off Kenya's Lamu Island in the southeast of the country. The small boat carrying 30 passengers and cargo was traveling from the island to the mainland when it capsized in rough seas. The region's deputy police commander said 20 people were rescued by local divers and police. 2 people, however, remain missing. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link with me, Eunice Njiro.
And I'm Abubakar Jallo.
As the world marks World Refugee Day, Burundi, one of East Africa's smallest countries, is home to over 60,000 refugees and asylum seekers. Burundian and UNHCR officials said 99% of them fled insecurity in the Democratic Republic of Congo. While Burundi is hosting such a large refugee population, over 400,000 citizens of its own have also sought exile in its neighboring countries following the country's 2015 crisis. From Bujumbura in Burundi, Apollinaire Nirora reports.
Ceremonies marking the World Refugee Day took place in the country's four refugee camps located in Ngozi, Muyinga, Ruyigi, and Chankuzo provinces. In a statement, the permanent secretary at the Burundian Home Affairs Ministry, Deworwe Ntwari, said by April the 30th, Burundi had received 3,921 asylum seekers and 58,800 refugees, most of them from the Democratic Republic of Congo. According to him, over 24,000 mainly live in the capital Bujumbura, while over 36,000 in refugee camps. Ruberi Ntwari commended the UNHCR for undertaking the program of relocating refugees to other countries.
The Burundian government particularly commends the program of relocating refugees in other countries underway since 2014 as a sustainable solution, even if before we had some challenges in fulfilling it.
During the celebration of the World Refugee Day in the capital Bujumbura, where a soccer game opposed urban refugee girls, Innocent Sangara, protection officer at the UNHCR Burundi office, thanked the country for continuing to receive refugees despite its difficulties.
The UNHCR would like to say that Burundi didn't fail its mission with regard to refugees, even when the country faced difficulties. Burundi continued to open doors for refugees.
The representative of urban refugees told DW that urban refugees are facing several challenges, including access to health services, as they have to pay 50% of medical bills. Here is Tambwe Barwani.
Life that we live here in Bujumbura is a life that is hard. That's mainly access to health services and non-recognition of our identity cards displayed to security agents.
Les agents de l'ordre, par exemple.
While Burundi received such a big number of refugees, the East African nation has itself over 400,000 citizens exiled in neighboring countries since 2015, following the controversial third term of Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza.
Apollinaire Niroro reporting.
And a couple of responses, Eunice. Didier from Rwanda said those Burundian refugees should not be forcibly repatriated. If what they feared, they fled, is still there, why force them? Lamine Fofanagbla from Montreal in Canada said Western nations are qualified to resettle refugees in Africa. Poor services and conditions are not enough for refugees. The world has more programs than the money to carry out the programs. The world has more refugees than the money to carry out the programs.
Thanks, Abu. Let's move on to the United States. Its President Donald Trump is expected to meet Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko later today for talks on security, political and economic issues. Poroshenko, who arrived in the United States on Monday, said that it was very important that his meeting in the White House would be earlier than Russian President Vladimir Putin's meeting. This will be their first meeting since Trump took office, and Poroshenko has met Michael Pence. Before coming on air, I spoke to DW's Karsten von Naumann in Washington, and I started by asking him why it was so important for President Poroshenko to meet President Trump before Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the Ukrainians are very much afraid that Donald Trump might be too lenient to Russia and President Putin when he meets him. So basically, I think the Ukrainian President Poroshenko wants to make sure that Trump knows the Ukrainian side of the story before he meets Putin. And also it is a kind of a propaganda victory for the Ukrainians if they have the first face-to-face encounter. I mean, both Putin and Poroshenko have talked to Trump a number of times on the phone, but there have been no personal meetings so far. So that is why it was so important for Poroshenko to meet with Trump.
So what can we say is the position of the U.S. when it comes to the conflict between Ukraine and Russia after President Trump took office?
Well, the problem is and was that Mr. Trump has always been a bit ambivalent about this issue. His ministers, also Mike Pence, the vice president, have repeatedly said no, everything that we agreed on, the sanctions against Russia because of the invasion and annexation of Crimea, because of the meddling in eastern Ukraine, will stay in place. Mr. Trump has never been very clear on that. He has continued his tune that he basically used during his election campaign, that it would be a good thing to have some kind of rapprochement with Russia. It would be good to get along with Russia because that, Mr. Trump's view, would be helpful in fighting terrorism in the Middle East and elsewhere. And this has been his most important issue. He's not so much interested in Ukraine, clearly, or in European affairs. What he's interested in is the fight against terrorism. This is something he has promised his voters, that he would be tough on terrorism. So he's open, that is quite clear, to cooperating with Russia, but also with many other regimes around the world, if it helps in the fight against terrorism. And that, of course, has always been worrying for the Ukrainians, because they feared, and probably still fear, that Mr. Trump, deep in his heart, is ready to strike a deal with Mr. Putin at the expense of Ukraine, if it helps to fight against ISIS and other terrorist groups.
I was speaking to DW's Carsten von Naumann in Washington. Now, the human rights chief, Prince Zeid Raad Al Hussein, has accused the Democratic Republic of Congo's government of backing a new militia behind horrific killings in Kasai region. More than 3,300 people have been killed since August, and the situation has deteriorated in the past 3 months. Fred Mvuni with the details.
Speaking at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, the UN rights chief accused the Congolese government of failing to protect its people. He said hundreds of villagers had been shot dead, hacked or burned to death, and mutilated in an apparent planned attacks carried out by Banamura militia. Observers said the Congolese army accompanied the militia during the attacks on villages. The UN team carrying out the investigation saw children as young as 2 years old whose limbs had been chopped off. The Human Rights Council is expected to vote this week on a proposal to authorize an independent investigation into the violence in Congo's Kasai region, including the murder of two UN experts earlier this year. Congolese Justice Minister Alexis Thambwe Mwamba rejected the call for an international investigation, saying it would be unacceptable to launch such an investigation without including Congolese officials.
Jane Yingi compiled that report.
And we have a couple of responses. Lamine Fofanagbola said any forms of violence should not be encouraged in Africa. At this time, Africans should be thinking of controlling their development. Now, let me take you to a different story. That is the Central African Republic, where the government has basically signed a peace agreement with rebel factions, which was mediated by the church. We have a response from Christopher Mofflan from the US, who said the peace deal in the CAR is very good news. Congrats to all the parties involved. Never ever give up on seeking peace. Your youth will live to remember your commitment to participatory democracy. And a final response from El Shadi Akwem from Ghana. He said this peace accord will not be ensure the desired peace that will ensure prosperity of the people. It goes beyond that. This implies DRC is negotiating with terrorists with the possibility of sharing government with them.
Well, do we know more about this peace deal that was signed by the CAR?
Well, basically, this is something that's been going on between the different factions, and now the government chose to mediate. The Catholic Church chose to come in there because both elements within the CAR respect the church. Even the anti-Balaka does respect the church, and as well as the Seleka rebel groups.
Well, thanks a lot, Abu, for those comments. Remember, we're looking forward to more of your comments on our Facebook page. Just go to DW Africa. This is Africa Link with me, Eunice Wanjiru.
And I am Abubakar Jallo.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, DW launches a new project called The African Roots at the Global Media Forum.
As I write, I think I'm documenting something. It's not colonial history, but it's a history of people. It's the way people lived in a certain year. It's the history of my people.
We have so many of your responses to this story. I think we will be able to bring all of them as the show continues.
Yeah, do stay with us for these stories. Plus, we meet a nurse who's helping returning migrants in Ethiopia. Now, for people who have a say in a globalized world, awareness of their own identity is crucial. History has played and continues to play an important part in shaping identities. However, in Africa, history is hardly documented by Africans. African history written by colonialists or Western scholars does not only provide a rather contested narrative, but is limited. Today at the Global Media Forum, DW launched a new project called African Roots. It aims to reclaim African history using African experts and journalists. Jena Yeko Kumet with more.
So, you're an African, but how much of your history do you know? This is exactly what DW's African Roots project is all about, informing people, especially Africans, about their roots. And as Klaus Stecker, DW's head of programs for Africa, put it, there is much to learn, especially for the young people.
Many youngsters lamented how much they learn about the colonial past and how little about their own African roots. We also make sure that we don't fall back in a colonial narrative again.
Many young Africans barely know their history, no African heroes. For Ugandan professor Edward Kirumira, the challenge of African history goes back to education and its financing.
If you look at African universities currently, you find that probably some of the weakest departments are departments of history. And so we have to start from there by looking at how we train the people that we expect to tell the African histories.
On the other hand, Cameroonian author and political activist Eno Meyomese says history is used to legitimate the government-owned power that makes it even difficult to write.
In a country like Cameroon, we have nothing concerning the last years of the fight for the independence. The French army went to war in Cameroon during 6 years. You will not find anything concerning that period in the history. Because if you teach it in school, it will be a big problem for the government of today and of the past, who has been presented as the savior of the country.
And now that we know that majority of Africans do not know much about their own history, do they really care about this? Ndinda Kioko is a young Kenyan writer and filmmaker, and this is what she had to say about reclaiming African history.
As I write, I think I'm documenting something. It's not colonial history, but it's a history of people. It's the way people lived in a certain year. It's the history of my people. I think it's important, you know.
DW's African Roots project will feature 25 episodes of some of Africa's unsung heroes.
A report by Jane Ayoko Kumet, who also attended the Global Media Forum.
And we did broadcast that event live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. If you'd like to see it, check out that page. And now for your responses, we've been asking on Facebook, how can Africa claim its history devoid of its colonial past? And Nashika Brown said, easy access for young Africans to documentation of history is critical. It's crucial, Early childhood education seems very important to ignite and maintain the interest in our own history. And Sam Bob said, I think definitely we Africans, we have lots of historical. What is not right, I think it will be better when we wrote our own historical document.
Abu, I'm sure you have more comments coming in from this.
Quite a lot of responses, and I'll bring them later in the show.
Looking forward to that.
Africa on the move.
For our Africa on the Move segment this week, we meet Abay Kasahun. She has dedicated her career to meet women who have faced abuse in foreign countries in search of greener pastures. Apart from psychological assistance, others need treatment and medical advice. Kasahun even visits her clients at home. Her job has earned her a nickname, which is the mobile nurse. Jane Nyingi brings us this report by Coletta Wanjohi.
I'm at Abai Kasahun office. I found her busy preparing to visit returnee migrants from the Middle East. Most of them are traumatized, having gone through a lot of suffering in the hands of their employers. They not only need medical, but also psychological help. Her organization, Live Addis, has so far assisted 183 of them.
Some are rape, some have some personal reproductive health problems. So I can go there and teach them how to use these protective materials. And this one is testing how to test their pregnancy at home and so on.
Apart from medical and psychological help, her organization also trains and helps them get a job. Today, she's meeting a group of women who came back home empty-handed after toiling in Arab countries. One of them is Ziwadin Sayum, who worked for 2 years in Beirut and later in Dubai. She says both of her female employers were inhumane and failed to pay her.
My father died when I was young. I quit school and opted to work for the Arabs, but I was not happy there.
Ms. Rak Abera also has a terrifying experience. She also worked in Beirut and her pay was $100 per month, but the worst was yet to come.
I had endured many challenges, but the sexual harassment from my employer's son was too much for me.
Abai Kasahun, commonly known as mobile nurse, says many of the women come back with sexually transmitted diseases.
As they migrated illegally and returned empty-handed, they have some psychological problem and some health-related problems like health, family planning matters.
Sometimes she's forced to visit some of the women at home, like 28-year-old Eleni Zaram, who gave birth 2 weeks ago. She worked in Dubai for 4 years. She doesn't want to go into details about what happened, but she sums up in one sentence, never again. Abai is there to offer her all the support she needs.
It's really important to us and for them to know their current status, what happened to them. This is our obligation to follow them, whether they are at class or not.
It takes time before the women open up and share their personal problems freely. That's why Nurse Abai is on call any time of the day. She believes the psychological healing of these women depends on having someone responding to them at any time.
That report was compiled by Coletta Wanjohi.
Focus Europe.
The world has a new museum that will be an interesting place to visit for budding entrepreneurs and, for that matter, for those who don't have the nerve to become budding entrepreneurs. Sweden's Museum of Failure in the south coast city of Helsingborg opened its doors on June the 7th. Our reporter John Lawrenson went to take a look.
In the Failure Museum with its creator, the psychologist Samuel West.
This is the Roland 303 synthesizer. The problem with it is that it sounds nothing like a bass guitar. And it wasn't popular. They couldn't basically not give them away. It was a weird sort of sound to it. And the manual weighed more than the actual device. Uh-huh. And then it was so difficult to program, so people just gave up.
There's usually a moral to the 70 tales of failure in this museum. Take Kodak, made a lot of money printing photos, invented the digital camera you can see in the museum, invented an online photo sharing site before Facebook and Instagram, but thought all that was good for was keeping their photo printing business going. Failed to change their business model, went bankrupt. But a failure doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. If you can learn from it, if you can keep going.
This is a good one. Tell us about this one.
Okay, you might wonder why there's a McDonald's hamburger carton behind glass in a museum. This is the McDonald's Arch Deluxe from 96. McDonald's had a reputation of being a children's restaurant, so that McDonald's says, hey, let's develop a burger for adults. And they invested $300 million. In 96, that's a lot of money. It failed because who's going to pay for a luxury burger from that establishment? And number two, they failed because their ad campaign showed children eating the adult burger and frowning with disgust.
The moral, don't forget who you are. Like for a couple of other turkeys in this museum, Harley Davidson perfume and Colgate ready-made dinners.
Nu så gör han ett uppsnack innan mötet.
Helsingborg City Council's head of future, Mikko Grönholm, addressing a conference on innovation. Helsingborg is Sweden's fastest growing city and a bit of a tech hub. The Failure Museum's organisers told me that while companies are busy organising private, even secret museum visits, all have refused to donate failed products. They don't want their names associated with the F word in any way. So I ask Mikko Grönholm, isn't he worried about making the city a sort of European failure capital?
I would love that, make Helsingborg a capital of failure. Because everybody that works with innovation, that works with new stuff, startups for instance, know that failure is important for innovation. If you want to innovate, if you want to develop something, if you do want something new, you have to accept that failure is not an option. You have to fail.
So this is Trump the Game.
Yeah, it's called I'm Back, You're Fired. It's a simplified and boring version of Monopoly. And the whole thing is to buy and sell Trump real estate and make a killing off of it. If you look at Trump, I could have an entire museum with just Trump products. Trump vodka, Trump steaks, Trump university, Trump this, Trump that. The guy is a walking pile of failure, and he's now the president of the United States. I see the brand Trump and him as a person as a living proof that you don't have to be so afraid of failure.
A report by John Lawrence. Now, Abu, I think that was a very interesting report, and I would like to visit this Museum of Failure in Sweden.
To be honest, when I listened to it, I just wanted to laugh because it's such a funny story.
It is,
really.
And quite interesting. Yeah. Well, do you have anything you would say that fits into this Museum of Failure?
If you take into consideration the amount of job interviews that I was rejected for, then... And if you can display that in a museum, then definitely you can put it there. But we also have a lot of projects that we know that are failed. Take, for example, here in Germany, StudiVZ.
Yes, which was actually
big failure.
More like a Facebook of Germany.
Yeah, in Africa, High Five.
Yes, yes, yes.
Failed big time.
Yeah. But I mean, we've heard that failure is also, you know, not the worst thing. I mean, the last thing we had was how President Trump, you know, failed in so many things, and now he is the president.
Yeah, the most important thing, you fail and then you don't give up, you get up again
up
and then
again.
Walk.
That's it.
Anyways, let me take you to a serious topic now, to a project that Deutsche Welle has launched at the Global Media Forum, which is the Africa Roots Project. We will be producing a series of small short videos on African pioneers. On that video, we have a couple of responses. And Bene Mwambene said, fear among African students in Africa of not wanting to study history is the job market. Besides that, there is also a fearsome political influence. Politicians decide what to be taught in schools. Samuel Ngesha said, African history have to be written by Africans instead of by Western, as most of our history is not being told the truth. And we have... El Shadi Akwen from Accra, Ghana, said, though colonization have scarred the continent, there is the need for Africans to clearly reach past the colonial era to document historical cultural heritage of the people. This is a sure way of ensuring national pride and patriotism of Africans. And the final story that we've been asking is a democracy fake in Africa. This is in response to a particular story, the AfriCologne Festival in Colonia in Germany. We have a response from Zach Mumuni. Sorry for pronouncing your name wrong there. He says, Africa's democracy has become an election ritual. It starts with election and ends with election. It is so empty, it only favors the thieving elites.
And I think Gideon Jubert says it's fake globally. Well, we don't know about that. Thank you, Abu, for those comments. The report Abu just read the comments about is on our page. That's dw.com/Africa. Visit there and you'll see it. You're also welcome to visit our Facebook page and leave your comments there. We'll be looking forward to having that on our studio. Thank you for keeping it Africa Link. Join us again same time tomorrow.